Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill. Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we have Kirsten Hartvig, and Kirsten is a naturopath, herbalist, educator, and author of 14 books. The newest one is Food as Medicine from Aeon, but you've also written books on dieting and medicinal berries, medicinal spices, and so I think this will be a really fun talk. But first, Kirsten, how are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. We have autumn here now in Sussex, the UK, where I am and have my garden, and there's lovely autumn colours now. We have this big storm that I think has come sort of from the Atlantic, but it passed us by, I'm really pleased to say. So the sun is out, and I'm doing a herb walk, or leading a herb walk tomorrow. So I've been praying for the storm not to be here. It'll be too wet tomorrow. So I'm pleased, I'm happy, and I'm very happy to be here with you. I've heard a bit about your project, and I think it's absolutely brilliant, and it's exactly the kind of thing that I would like to, or I'm doing as well. So I'm pleased to connect with you.
Wonderful. That's awesome.
Awesome. Thank you. So Kirsten, how did you come to the plant path?
Well, I think it's always been in my bones in a way, because I'm Danish, and I come from Jutland in Denmark, and from really sort of countrified. To give you the perspective, my dad came from a place called Stony Place, and my mother came from a place called Turnip.
That's awesome.
And they're all still there. I have a big family that are all sort of craftspeople or farmers or growers or so on. And I think I'm one of the only ones that got away. And I really wanted to learn the medicinal side of plants, and I couldn't find anywhere to do that in Denmark. So I came to the UK. There was a school called the School of Herbal Medicine, led by a herbalist called Hein Seilstra back in the 1980s. And I trained there. It took 4 years to become a medical herbalist. And then I just never went back, because I found my tribe here. I think, you know, there's a very nice community here in the UK of herbalists and herb lovers. And I met my husband as well, who is a doctor, but also really interested in naturopathy and herbal medicine. And while I studied, it was very sort of old fashioned with white coats and tinctures and so on. But I got more and more interested in the herbs that are also foods, or that you can find in your garden as a weed or a vegetable, or in out on your walks, sort of local herbs. And so I carried on with a postgraduate training in naturopathy. And that's really where I found my home, because that incorporates lifestyle and food and diet and dietetics and hydrotherapy and things like that. So that was the start of my herbal journey. And then I also, via that, became more and more interested in lifestyle and in the way that, and seeing that it's all very well to go and see a practitioner for an hour, even though that's a long time in medicine.
Yeah.
The rest of your day or your week you spend in the place where your problems started, and that it can be difficult to translate what you learned in that hour into the life that you lead. So I started having people come and stay at in our home, sort of on retreat, and to treat them sort of in inpatient style, and had really good results with that, because just showing how you do, like how you prepare good food, how you look after yourself, gave me really good results, combined with the herbs, of course. And that led to Nick and I starting a retreat center, first in on the west coast of Jutland in Denmark. And then we bought a place down in the French Pyrenees, where we ran a retreat up in the mountains for over a decade. And that was such a good experience, because, in fact, it taught us that we did very little apart from create a space where people could relax and have good foods, clean water, fresh air, and some exercise and social, you know, have social interaction with others and be able to talk about your life and so on. And Nick is also a composer who's very interested in singing and chanting and so on. So we did lots of singing with people and meditation and things like that, and realized that the plants are an important part, but in fact, the way you live is really what matters most. And I think that's also what we're finding with that what plants are showing us now. We're opening our eyes more and more to the fact that plants are individuals just like we are, and they live in family groups and cultures, and we can learn from them in other ways than just harvesting them and making them into something we can eat or take. So that's really my plant journey that has now led me to the Healing Garden, where, which is a big medicinal herb garden where we grow herbs, but we also have volunteers come and learn, and we teach courses and so on. So it's kind of the same journey now in a new place.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
That retreat center sounds so lovely. I'm wondering how folks can bring some of those elements of the retreat, of like leaving your day to day to go somewhere and to have the healing foods and that social aspect and the songs and, you know, the fresh air. Like, how can you bring some of those retreat moments and special aspects of retreats into your home, you know, on the day to day?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And in fact, we wrote a book called 10 Days to Better Health to show that, how you can do a retreat at home, because we realized after having done it for some years that there is a pattern to what happens. Like the first day, people are always really sort of busy and want to see everything and do everything. And then that carries on into the second day. And the third day, any kind of troubles or aggressions or things come out. And the first many times we took it personally, because like in one when we were on the west coast by the sea in Denmark, we had some people come and complain that the waves were too high because they wanted to go swimming.
Please turn down the waves, ma'am. They're too high.
And then we had other people coming and complain that the waves weren't big enough because they wanted to surf.
You were promised bigger waves.
What? We thought the West Coast, this is the North Sea. and we learned not to take it personally, but that it's part of the detox, you know, when you leave your home behind. And so we developed this program that you can do at home that also has a herb each day and an essential oil each day for you to, so you can treat yourself at home and incorporate the retreat into your everyday life. And there's just one day in the middle where you do a little mini fast, because of course in naturopathy fasting is a big thing. It's the catabolic system, and that's on day five when you've had enough time to kind of relax. And we found that some people were just incredibly tired and would just sleep and sleep and sleep. And in fact, there was one woman that arrived that was in Denmark, an older woman that arrived from, she'd had some traumatic experiences. In fact, with her, she had left her house to her daughter and son-in-law on the promise that she could stay there for the rest of her life. You know, they would share it and look after her. But basically, they just wanted to get rid of her. And of course, that wasn't very nice. But when she came to us, we didn't know any of that, just that she was really tired. And she arrived and slept for 24 hours. And we thought, God, is she dead? You know,
yeah.
I would sneak in and see, is she still breathing? But she was just tired. And you find things like that. And of course, you can't give a herbal medicine or a diet for that. You have to see that, where is that person in their life? And so that's what we did in that, the 10 Days to Better Health book, which will be coming out, I think, next year again with the
Yes. So you mentioned that you have this healing garden and you're here in your clinic space with your trusty therapy dog. I would love to hear more about that, your space and what you do now with your apothecary and what your garden is like.
Yes, so the garden is, so we have about an acre, which is part of the Emerson Gardens. And Emerson College is an old anthroposophical college that has now broadened out. So our aim with the garden is to combine biodynamics, which is part of anthroposophy, with botanics and horticulture and herbal medicine or the healing arts. And in our part of the garden, we have about an acre or 2 acres maybe of medicinal plants. We have 420 different species here, and we're part of the BGCI, which is called the Botanic Gardens Conservation International. And we have a botanist that works with us once a week, whose her specialty is native plants. So it's just so amazing to have her, because even though I think I'm quite good at identification, when you work with someone who has, that's their specialty, it's absolutely incredible. She works, yeah. She runs the, there's a place called Wakehurst here, which is, that has a millennium, it's called the Millennium Seed Bank. They have sort of seeds from thousands of plants from all over the world. And she runs the greenhouse next to that, where, and she grows the seeds that when they get seeds, they don't know what it is. So she propagates them and so on. So she comes here once a week, which is fantastic. And then we have a gardener as well that works with us. And because in a way, the garden is quite labor intensive, but in another way, it isn't, because we are completely no dig and sort of permaculture no dig. And so we use all our grass cuttings for mulching, and we hardly do any weeding, because we just mulch on top of the heat of the weeds. And then we're creating a couple of flower meadows where we, which is, I don't know if you know how, you know, it's quite labor intensive to create a flower meadow, but once it's there, it's brilliant. You have to mow at the right time and so on. So, So that's what we do. And then we harvest our plants and use them in the dispensary. We also propagate plants that we then sell to, there's a couple of farm shops where we sell our potted plants. And that's, in fact, we have a Greek partnership garden called the Botanic Garden of the Crucia Mountains in northern Greece near Thessalonica. And their big idea was to go out to different parts of Greece and find plants that are endangered, then take them specimens back to their garden and propagate them, and then either put them back but also sell them to people in garden centers and so on, so that the Greeks could start growing their native flora instead of importing geraniums or whatever.
Yeah.
And they had that was very successful. So we have adopted that system. So we are now growing all these different plants and selling them to farm shops. And it's very successful, because people are intrigued by what you can grow, and finding also, of course, that it's a lot easier to grow native plants than imported plants.
100%. Yeah.
I think,
it's funny how that works.
Native plants are kind of having a renaissance right now. Everyone's totally very excited about them, and for good reason.
Yeah.
And also your garden sounds like very close to what we're going for, our vision. So that's pretty cool.
I'm really pleased to connect with you for that, because it's so wonderful. So it's like a movement, isn't it? That is that more and more people are getting in, becoming interested in just doing things naturally and working with nature instead of trying to kill it or poison it or so we have our big thing is that we value all life forms, and everyone is welcome here, whatever your race or species or religious conviction. So we have an owl box. We got a grant via the BGCI for owl bird boxes. So we have a barn owl that lives in a barn in a box in one of the big oak trees. We have bat boxes and lots of other, and we have two buzzard boxes that are also inhabited now. And we have lots of bird boxes for smaller birds as well.
So then we have boxes for different sized birds is in order.
Sure. And it's the hole in them as well that and where they're positioned and so on. Mm. We had a bird expert come and help us put them up and advise us on what to put.
I love that.
Yeah. And then we've built an insect hotel and the BB&B, And that's for, so they are actually different, which I didn't know. An insect hotel has to be kept wet or watered from time to time, because it needs to be sort of a little bit like a compost heap, but we just have put pallets on top of each other and then a grass roof on it. But the bee hotel, the bees have to be kept dry.
Yeah.
And that the bee hotel is for, or the B&B as we call it, is for solitary bees. And there are over 200 different species of solitary bees that are not like honeybees at all. Yeah. So yeah, and they need, so we put that, and someone gave us a really beautiful old, or tiles from a really old roof. So they're red tiled roof they have on it. So it's very beautiful. And we then created a flower meadow surrounding the B&B.
Lovely.
And then we have 5 beehives, all of bees that have come, swarms that have come to the garden. And we have a woman who's, she's like a bee whisperer. She's one of those people, queen bees. You can have bees like hands covered in bees and everything in the stones. So we have, they're in different parts of the garden. We don't take the honey. We just have them to give them a home and help with propagation and help honeybees.
Cool.
Yeah. So and then there's all the plants.
You said 420 species.
Yeah, that's right.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah.
Is there any plant that really stood out this year in the garden that you're like, wow, that was the star of the show? Who called to you this year?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good question. I think we had, the one that springs to mind is clary sage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have grown that, but I've never really sort of paid much attention to it. And you can get a lot of volatile oil out of it, as essential oil in it. It's a fantastic scent. The leaves are so scented. And it's a very good sort of natural antiseptic that also has sort of very uplifting sides to it. And when you smell it, you can... if you rub the leaves in your fingers, it's very sticky, and you get this sort of sticky, uplifting, sort of clean feeling, which is very nice. Do you grow that in your garden as well?
We don't have that right now.
I've grown it a few years ago, and it was magnificent. Yeah,
but it reminds me. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, go on.
Well, the how you're describing clary sage. Reminds me how my favorite plant over the last few months has been New England aster, which is a very dark purple, beautiful aster, which with a lot of resins in it that also has this uplifting, clean, resinous smell to it. So that's what was coming to my mind as you're talking about clary sage.
Yeah, I love asters. I think they're the most beautiful flowers of all.
Yeah,
I loved it. They're sort of deep pastel colors in a way. I really love those. Yeah, and the clary sage is quite big as well. It's like a meter tall, and it's
mine didn't get that tall. It was like 1 foot.
I think we're a little too cold for it.
it's a good climate here in Sussex, and we're on a south facing slope. Yeah, it's very nice, and it's very warm and lush. We get quite a lot of rain as well. So,
sounds like a wonderful area to grow plants in. Yeah, Sussex, that's one of the warmer areas of England, right?
Yeah, it's in the southeast. So, yeah, I think we get the Gulf Stream coming up through the English Channel. So we benefit from that. The thing that I hadn't realized was that we also get the prevailing wind here is from the south, which being a Dane, I'm used to it being either north or west when the prevailing wind. And since we're south facing as well, a couple of years ago, we had the hedges laid, and then realized that was a really bad idea because the greenhouse blew away on several occasions that year.
Oh, no.
So now we've let them grow again, and we've learned from experience that we need the shelter from the wind.
Yeah, that's the thing, that every area and every site is so different and has different conditions, and it takes a while to learn them, but that's one of the fun things too, getting to know the land that you live in.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think my favorite plant of all time is yarrow.
Oh yeah.
Do you grow that as well?
Well, yeah. It grows itself.
I think someone mowed in the past, but we have not mowed, and it's so lush.
Yeah. And I really love it because it's really easy to grow because, as you say, it just grows itself. Mm-hmm. But it's also one of the most useful plants, I think, in the pharmacopoeia. Mm-hmm. And they say that yarrow is first and last because the Latin name is Achillea millifolium. So that means that in the dispensary, if it's sorted under Latin names, it'll be the first plant. And the of course, the common name is yarrow, which is the other end of the alphabet. Right. But also in terms of use, it's such a useful plant. Internally, it's all about microcirculation, and it opens up the microcirculation. And since one of the magical things about the body is that no matter what we do and how big we are, how young or old we are, how fat or slim we are, the blood supplies all the about 30 trillion cells that we consist of and make sure that at any point, whatever we're doing, whether we're running a marathon or sleeping or eating or whatever we do, every single cell has what it needs, gets the nutrients it needs, and gets its toxins taken away, and that's all done by the blood. So the blood is, that's why in old herbal medicine they were all talking about blood cleansers as the most important, one of the most important actions. And yarrow it can be used as a blood cleanser, but what it does is it opens up the microcirculation, so enabling the blood to come to the furthest corners of the body, and that is means that it has all sorts of different actions that are to do with opening microcirculation. So, for example, it lowers blood pressure because by opening up the circulation, that gives more space for the blood. But it's also what we call a diaphoretic or febrifuge, which is something that lowers fever, and also diaphoretic is helping you get rid of heat. And of course, you do that by opening up circulation again and opening up circulation to the skin. And what's one of the things that I think is so amazing about the body is that when we need to cool down, we sweat, and that puts a layer of water on our skin. And of course, water cools. So that way, the skin is used as a natural coolant. I just think that's mind-bogglingly brilliant. And that's another function. Yeah, that's another function of yarrow. And then it's also bitter, mm-hmm. and that means it stimulates the liver. And since the liver is like the body's kitchen, anything that makes the kitchen work better will make everything else work better because it processes everything that is sort of in that we, everything that we're nourished by, goes through the liver to get processed and sorted out where you're going next and so on. And then it has this amazing dual action that you can both cause bleeding. So it's called nosebleed is one of its actions. And that is, you can use that in emergency. If someone's blood pressure is too high, you want having a nosebleed is a natural action. And if you want to cause high blood pressure to fall, you can provoke a nosebleed. And that's what you can do with a yarrow leaf. It's called millefeuille, which it's 1,000 leaves, because the leaves are really sharp. Every little leaflet has quite sharp edges. So if you want to provoke a nosebleed, but maybe don't do this at home, you stuff a yarrow leaf up in your nostril, and then you pull it out. Because it's so sharp, it causes a nosebleed. So that's one of the old uses of it.
That's so cool.
But conversely, if you crush the leaf and get access to the cell content and the active constituents in the cells, and you have a nosebleed, you can also put it up your nostril and stop a nosebleed with the same leaf, but just by using what's inside the cells instead of on the outside.
That's and so amazing. You can use
it as a styptic, it's called, which is an old word for stopping bleeding. Mm-hmm. And so you can use it. It's also called soldier's wound weed. So I've seen this many times that if you have a bleeding cut, you just crush up the leaf to get to what's inside and put it on, and it stops the bleeding quite miraculously and very quickly.
Yeah, I guess that's why it's called like Achillea, because Achilles was the famous hero who could only be wounded in his ankle. Well,
in his Achilles heel. Yeah.
Yeah. Heel, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it.
And so, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. And it's all to do with the blood, I think, in many ways. And that, of course, is also makes it a really good herb to use for infectious diseases like COVID, because it has antimicrobial active constituents as well, something called gamasoline, which is essential oil. And so it's also antimicrobial, so it's great for infections. In an infection, it's fantastic that it kills the invaders. It also opens up circulation so that you can get rid of a temperature that runs too high. And it also helps the blood and the immune system get to every single cell to find the invaders. And also the COVID has been found to be a virus that actually affects microcirculation, and which is why it's so dangerous, because in the bottom of the lungs, there's lots of microcirculation to make sure you get oxygen in and carbon dioxide out. And yarrow is perfect for sort of cleaning up microcirculation everywhere. So it's a good COVID plant too.
Wow.
Definitely.
And do you use it more as a tea or as a tincture or glycerin? Yeah, how do you use it most?
So I have sort of since the beginning specialized in just using teas and things you can make yourself.
Yeah.
Partly because I practiced in Denmark and in France, and there you can't really use tinctures and you can't prescribe the way the laws are. Here in England, herbalists can prescribe herbal medicine, but there you can't. So I worked out I just wrote prescriptions of teas, and then people could go and get them in a health food shop or wherever, and the herbal supplier. And because you're not allowed to, if you're telling people what a plant is good for, you're not allowed to sell it, because then it's called a health claim. And that was set up to protect people from snake oil sellers and also from greengrocers saying, buy my carrots because they will help with your cancer or whatever. But because herbs are seen as classified as foods, that is also that affects herbal practitioners. But you can say whatever you want as long as you're not selling it. So I specialized then in saying what I wanted, but telling people go and buy this somewhere else. Okay. And I write prescriptions of different herbal mixtures, and that's how I got into doing that. And I have sort of carried on doing that. And even though I have my own dispensary now, it's still based on herbs as they are, or herbs are used as foods, hence the book Food as Medicine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have another book on berries as medicine, sort of maybe a precursor to this book. And that's a subject that I'm very interested in. I just, first of all, love berries. And for some reason, I'm just like thinking about berries all the time right now. We got blueberries, we got hawthorn berries. I just got some American mountain ash, rowan trees. I'm excited about planting those. Get some rowan berries.
Berries are going right now. They're so yummy.
but berries are one of those magical foods that is definitely a food as medicine situation. You know, a lot of berries are strictly medicinal. I mean, elderberries, like there's some sea berries, but goji berry, you can just go at rose hips, but they're also a wonderful food that people eat all the time. Like, and that's one of the reasons I'm growing a lot of blueberries, because I mean, they're a native plant here, but all of our neighbors, people aren't going to necessarily like my gumi berries or my other weird fruits that I'm growing, but everyone knows what blueberries are and everyone loves them. And they're also actually very medicinal too. So why berries as medicine?
Well, it's great you're interested in berries because I share the same love. And in the healing berries, I found 50 different berries. Or in fact, I found many more, but I had to, the publisher said I had to limit myself to 50. And the reason I absolutely love berries is because they are, in fact, the part of the plant that the plant wants us to eat. Mm-hmm. The plant produces berries for us to eat them and says, here you are, you know, this is, and it's the perfect symbiosis because the deal is supposed to be that we eat the berries and then we go and deposit the seeds somewhere with a nice pile of fertilizer. Of course, that was all upset by flushing toilets, but until flushing toilets appeared, that was the deal, and that's still the deal with animals and birds. That the plant gives you something to keep you healthy, so that you can help with its propagation. And I just think that's absolutely beautiful. And therefore, berries are also like powerhouses of nutrition. They are very high in active constituents, and many of the active constituents help the immune system. So, for example, the rowan you just talked about is a fascinating plant as well because it contains something called sorbic acid, mm-hmm. which is which is slightly poisonous, but as soon as the berry has had frost and it goes soft, then the sorbic acid changes into another form that isn't poisonous. And I think that's another absolutely genius thing, because if you notice at the moment, we have got lots of grapes here just outside my window and they are ripening, and the birds come and the bees and the wasps and the insects come and eat them now. And they don't go anywhere near the rowan berries and the sloes, but when they've then eaten, then the next comes the rose hips and the elders, they've eaten already, and they haven't quite finished with the hawthorn. But then when all the other berries have been eaten, we still have the rowan, because the birds don't eat them because they're still poisonous. But as soon as the frost comes, you see then the berries, they start eating the rowan berries as well. And I just think, isn't that absolutely brilliant that nature is like that, that we're keeping these for later and we're just making sure you can't eat them.
That's so cool.
And another berry that I'm fascinated by is from the yew tree.
Oh, yew. Okay.
So that's not actually a berry. It's because the yew tree is from before berries were invented. They're actually fleshy cones, but they look like little red berries.
A beta version.
Yeah.
Beta berry.
Beta berry. It's cute.
And what's so fascinating about that is that every single part of the yew tree is wildly poisonous. Mm-hmm. And then the seed inside the berry is full of cyanide. So if you eat, you can eat the berry, the red bit, and it's absolutely brilliant. But if you chew the seed, you basically had it. And what's so fascinating about that is that the yew tree is one of the oldest species that we know. And I think that it has survived so long because everyone who realized what the deal was survived, and everyone who broke the deal didn't. And plants are so amazing like that. And so you see in that red color that you see in the yew tree and the yew berry, and also in the rowan and hawthorn berries as well, that's both, you can see on the berry that it contains vitamin A, because that is that sort of red yellow color. And it also, if it has a red sort of bluish tinge, that's anthocyanins, mm-hmm. which are very powerful antioxidants that help body cells. We have a turnover all the time of body cells, and the faster the turnover, the more chance there are for what is called free radicals, which are like bits of dead cell that hasn't quite broken down. And they are the ones that people say, oh, be careful of free radicals. But all they are is just broken cells that haven't been processed by the immune system yet. Mm. And what antioxidants do is they stop the oxidation of these free radicals, which, so oxidation is a bit like rust on your car. It's when mm-hmm. something is being broken down, and the that oxidation process can sort of go wrong. So it creates like almost a rotting process in the tissues, which is really bad news because that can lead to all sorts of degenerative diseases. But what the antioxidants do is they are like, if you know, if you cut an avocado in half, then it starts going black or brown if you leave it out. But if you take lemon juice and put over it, then it stays the same color. And that's because the vitamin C in the lemon juice is an antioxidant. And that's what they did. So they're called antioxidants because they stop oxidation.
Amazing. And
lots of berries, that's what they do. And so they just help the body work better. And then they also specialize in, like the hawthorn berry specializes in the helping the heart work better. And the amazing thing about the hawthorn berry is that it increases the strength and force of the heart without raising the blood pressure. In fact, you can use it to lower blood pressure.
Yeah.
Which is it's something that helps your endurance and athletic performance. So many athletes have now started taking hawthorn berries to help them with their general circulation and their hearts, help their heart pumping better. So that's what hawthorn berry has specialized in. And it's also a really good, you can use it as an anti-cholesterol remedy, because it helps you get rid of blood fats that have collected in your arteries. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, will also help lower the blood pressure, because when you clean up your arteries, you have more space, and they help. It helps make arteries more elastic, which, of course, they will be if you take away all the fatty plaques that can build up by cholesterol and the other bad fats. So hawthorn berries have specialized in that, as well as being antioxidant and very nourishing in their own way. And something like blueberries that you talked about that you were growing, they're also antioxidant, but they have also specialized in eyesight. Mm. So they contain active constituents that help everything to do with bad eyesight or eye problems. So you can always eat lots of blueberries to keep your eyes working well, and have some carrots as well for that.
Carrot blueberry salad, maybe.
Yeah, that could be good. So berries are just magic in my view. Like the elderberries as well are also really strong antivirals. And the amazing thing is that the berries, most of them come out now at this time of year where we really need them, where this is the flu and cold season coming up.
Yeah.
And the other brilliant thing about them is that they're easy to either freeze or dry or conserve in other ways, so you have them all winter.
Oh my gosh. One of our new friends from the plant cutting conference that we hosted this year gave us a jar of elderberry garlic honey. And it was like fresh elderberries, fresh garlic in a jar with honey over it. It became like an elderberry syrup. You could also munch on the berries and the garlic if you need a little extra. And it's my new favorite.
Wow.
Consuming elderberry. It's
I've never tried that. I've got some dried. I'll have to
try it.
That sounds really, really nice. Ooh, thank
you. Kind of mellows out the garlic a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, because it's hard to get garlic, but sometimes garlic is really the medicine that you might need. And it mellows it out, makes it sweeter. So
yeah, it can, but it can be hard to get your patients to take garlic, so that's a great way of taking it.
It is.
Because of course that's the most important part of any prescription is patient compliance. It doesn't matter how good.
I've learned that over and over.
Here, mm-hmm. take this bone set and liver vein tincture 3 times a day.
Maybe not.
How about schizandraberry? Have you worked with that much?
Pardon? Sorry?
Have you worked with schizandraberry much?
Not that much, but it's a really, I haven't grown it, but I do have it in the dispensary. And I use it because it's another and very good antioxidant. Mm. And it's also a stimulant. So you can use it to release energy. Because one of the things that I have learned over the years to kind of realize is that you can't not have energy because we're made of energy. But you can have lots of, I mean, every single cell in us, we know now from quantum physics, we are just made of energy, even though we think we're sort of solid, it's all sort of, every atom is energy, and we're more non-substance than substance. Mm-hmm. And since we're made of energy, you can't actually say that you haven't got energy. But what you can have is lots of resistance and no access to your energy. Ooh. And that is what I use Shishanda for, to give you access to your energy when you have either because of resistance or because of, you know, that can be mental or emotional or physical as well. But it lifts your energy levels by sort of, and I see that as it gives you access to the energy that you're made of.
So ooh, I love that. Removes the obstacles to your energy. That's amazing. Cool.
Yeah.
I actually just made a little blend for Isaac and I because we wanted to access some more energy. And I used Shizandra, and I call it mush energy. And I put Shizandra and Reishi and turkey tail and some other mushrooms that we wanted to take on the daily. But the Shizandra was giving us energy. Is there anything else that you would recommend to add to like an energy formula?
I think another thing that's great that we are just about to harvest now is ginkgo. Do you have a ginkgo tree in your?
I have a small ginkgo. I got a variety that is self-pollinating, so it'll have the berries. Oh. That's what it says. We'll see in 10 years.
yeah, because they grow very slowly. Yeah.
It's a very small tree.
Yeah, and they grow so incredibly slowly that. Yeah. I think the one we have must be at least 50 years old, and it's not, it's the size of a birch tree. It's not.
And so when do you harvest it, and what are you harvesting of it?
The leaves.
So that's the leaves, and they have most active constituent when they turn yellow. Mm-hmm. So they just suddenly turn yellow, and then the great thing about that is that then they also fall, so they're much easier to harvest.
Totally. I'm a 50-year-old tree, it's hard to get up there.
Yeah. And but they are a very nice I think sort of energy release type, or that they are also all about microcirculation and circulation to the head, really good for older people to sort of open up circulation and thereby give access to both memories and energy sources. A bit like I see it a bit like rosemary is also rosemary for remembrance, and it opens up circulation to give you access to your memories. That's how I see it. And you can also use it to deal with sort of traumatic memories and so on. Rosemary.
Yeah,
that's a good point too.
That's one of the things I love about the ginkgo too, is like it works with the memory and the brain, but it's such an ancient tree, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. It's like bringing that ancient memory with it.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, because it's the only surviving species of the of its family. There's only ginkgo is the only member of the ginkgo family, and it's also called a temple tree. And it's such a survivor because, you know, back in Japan when Hiroshima and Nagasaki was bombed, and everything was sort of obliterated, the only things that survived were the ginkgo trees in the monasteries, because they put them in the middle of the courtyards. And so that also says that it's very good at absorbing pollution and surviving pollution. So now, for example, in London, they planted them along the roads everywhere. Obviously, we shouldn't use those leaves. But it is kind of a survivor. It's a tree that's, I think it also, as you say, Isaac, it gives you access to sort of deeper parts of yourself or the more spiritual part of yourself. And I think that's also why it was planted in temples.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It does have that spiritual energy because it was kept alive by temples in China and Japan. And that, like, that apparently that's the only place that it grows in the wild is in those temples.
I've seen temples. I've seen pictures of some of them that are absolutely ancient, sort of thousands of years old, and they are absolutely huge. And when you think about how slow they grow, it's amazing that they have lasted that long. And I think that there's something really amazing about connecting with time, that something that goes back that far. That's why I think trees also, like Thuja is an amazing tree, because that's also one of those ancient gymnosperms, as they're called, from before flowers were invented. So ginkgo and pines are from that era, and they all have sort of very sort of specific specialized actions, as you could say, as everything was sort of simpler in those days. And so they also have sort of, like Thuja is a brilliant antiseptic, and also that you can use, it's also antifungal and antiviral, and so it's great for infections, and it has that sort of strength with it that goes back millennia.
Yeah, the Thuja grows around here. We have Thuja occidentalis, I think that's the Latin, but Eastern white cedar, and that does grow natively around here. But it's another plant that you see people growing in their yards, but especially also in cemeteries it grows, which is similar to the yew. The yew is a tree of life and death. You know, they plant it at the cemeteries. But what an interesting plant, amazing plant with a lot of actions going on. Also, like, more spiritually, magically, it's a fantastic cleansing plant and protecting and cleansing the space. Yeah. So that's a great tree. Those medicinal trees, I love them. You know?
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I love them too. Yeah, yeah. We have some Thuyas down, and it's also occidentalis we have down in the garden. And we have some really big ones, so that I don't know how old they are. They're old, I think, and they have come from America. Someone brought them over from America when garden was established. So it's very special.
Well, I think we should probably get to food as medicine before we...
we're traveling far.
Out of time. Yeah, but one of the things I definitely want to talk about, because you're talking about a lot of different things in food as medicine, but you go into vitamins a lot, which I think would be a good segue from berries, for instance, because berries are one of those vitamin-packed as medicine foods. So what are the essential vitamins, and what are the most essential vitamins?
Well, they're all essential, aren't they, in each their way. But I can tell you about one of the things that when I did the research, so this book has taken about 30 years to write, because I've always been interested in food as medicine. But this is, so it's like my collection of everything I've picked up over the last 30 years. And so it's sort of old wisdom together with new research. But one of the things that when I finally sat down and wrote it all down, was I started thinking about, well, where do vitamins actually come from? And, you know, where are they created? And one of the things that, so I looked at, so the fat-soluble vitamins are A, D, E, and K. And then there's the water solubles, which are C and the B group vitamins. And I read some of it, because I'm vegan. I've been vegan since 1988. So showing here, I'm still alive.
And, that's when I was born.
I was born that year as well in vegan terms. But and it was actually because Roberts, what's his name? Wrote the book Diet for a New America, that really inspired me then. But anyway, so I was looking at vitamin D and thinking, because people say you can't get vitamin D without eating having animal products. So I thought, well, it's interesting, because I can get vitamin D, vegan vitamin D drops, so I wonder where they come from. Mm-hmm. And then I looked up lots of different sources, and then I saw some vitamin D drops were actually contained lanolin. So I started thinking, why would they contain lanolin? That's really weird. So of course we get vitamin D from the sun. Like yeah. we make, so it's like our photosynthesis, plants photosynthesize sunlight yeah. and we photosynthesize vitamin D on our skin. And because animals' skin is covered in fur, they actually synthesize vitamin D in their skin, in the fat in the skin, because it's fat soluble vitamin. Mm-hmm. And then when they groom themselves, they ingest the vitamin D, and that's how they get it. So I thought, wow, that's absolutely amazing. Then yeah. I also saw that some of the supplements, vitamin D supplements for vegans, were made from mushrooms. Mm-hmm. So I started looking into that. And lo and behold, this has just been this year's revolution for me. It then turns out that mushrooms, fungi, make vitamin D. Something yep. that I didn't know. Mm. And even you can take your mushrooms from the supermarket and just put them in a windowsill, I think it's for about an hour. Mm. And when they're exposed to sunlight, even through the window, they will make vitamin D. So you can use them, mushrooms, as your vitamin D source, which I, you know, that's just blown my mind once again. I just think plants and the natural world is so incredible. Mm-hmm. And the other revelation was vitamin B12, because that's mm-hmm. the other thing for vegans. Where do you get your vitamin B12? We always get asked. So I started thinking about, so where do they come from? And I did know sort of in theory that vitamin B12 is actually, it's what's called a gut commensal, which is a kind of bacteria that lives in the intestines, and that we can make some of our own vitamin B12 there. And that it's in the large intestine it's absorbed from. And then I started looking into if you are you're a pig or a chicken or something like that, where do you get your vitamin B12 from if you are stuck indoors in a factory farm? Because the other place you get what vitamin B12 really is, that they are soil bacteria is vitamin mm-hmm. B12. So if you live a sort of Stone Age life where you don't wash your vegetables too much and so on, you get, by getting a bit of soil in your food, you get your vitamin B12, and that's how wild animals get it as well. So I started thinking, so how do factory farmed animals get it? Because they don't have access to that. And then it turned out they're given a supplement, but since animals also make their vitamin B12 in their intestines, it comes out in your poo, in ours and theirs. So the supplements that are given to factory farmed animals is actually chicken poo. That's their vitamin B12 supplement. And that is kind of thought provoking as well, I think, that, you know, we think, and then of course it's in our organs and in our muscles. So when you eat the animals, you get the vitamin, it passed on to the next link in the food chain. And of course, you'd probably rather have a burger and then a chicken poo supplement. But
I probably definitely would prefer that to chicken poo.
Yeah.
But you can also get it in drops. And of course, it's also made by algae in the sea. Mm, uh-huh. And it kind of, it changed my perspective of, you know, plants really are the foundation for life here on Earth. And that's why I have, in food as medicine, I've just concentrated on the plant foods. Mm-hmm. There would be no life on Earth if it wasn't for plants. They are, you know, they, via photosynthesis, they make solar energy into a chemical energy that we can then eat as carbohydrates. And then we then transform that into fats, and so do the plants, fats and oils and so on. And we make protein as well from the building blocks from the earth, but with the energy used for that we get from the sun. So everything comes from the sun, whether we then choose to pass it through another animal before we and live higher up the food chain or eat things directly is kind of our choice. But what became apparent to me in writing Food as Medicine is you can actually get everything from plants, because animals get everything from plants. And that I just found that's amazing.
And yeah, then plants and fungi.
And fungi, yes. Sorry, I have to include the fungi, because fungi are just another
kingdom
that completely blows my mind as well.
Well, that's one of the amazing things about the fungi. When we found out that they make vitamin D a couple years ago from our mushroom friends, like we started putting out all the mushrooms that we harvested into the sun and doing that, because we really need vitamin D in the winter here in the northern hemisphere. But also finding out, like, basically humans are photosynthesizing to get vitamin D in the first place.
Yeah, it's so amazing, isn't it? It's just so brilliant. Yeah, and we need vitamin D here as well, absolutely. And if we can't, and of course you should, if you can't either get natural mushrooms that have had some sunlight or make it get out enough and expose your skin to the sun, then you do need to take a supplement, absolutely.
And why is that? What is, if we don't have enough vitamin D, what goes wrong?
So the vitamin D is... It's part of important enzymes in the body that just makes everything. It's like the catalyst in the body that makes everything work. So it's a very important vitamin to have. Most of the vitamins, in fact, are they are enzymes that just sit in between, like that. They're like catalysts, you know. Mm-hmm. So they don't have a function of their own, but without them, something can't be converted into something else. So release of energy, for example, is one of the vitamin D's actions. And that's why if you don't have it, you just feel tired and you don't have access to the energy that you're made of. If you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I think if there's also a correlation between, in the Northern Hemisphere, vitamin D deficiency and the flu and cold season.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, so it's part of the immune system as well. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's a very important vitamin, and that's why everyone's so hot on you getting, having enough of it. So immunity and energy and your whole fat and metabolism is vitamin D as well. And of course, vitamin B12 is all about nerve conduction. So if you don't have enough, you start getting pins and needles, and your nerve, you can get quite serious nerve damage if you don't have enough vitamin B12.
And where do you find that in nature?
So that's the chicken poo, or in algae, or in soil. You make it yourself, and it's also in nature. It's also in the soil, so it's soil bacteria that make vitamin B. So it is a bacterium. It's not so you don't have to eat.
It's in a high amount in like organ meats, especially, right? Which is why people are into the organ meats. But so one of the other. Does nutritional yeast have vitamin B12?
Yes, it does. Yeah, that's one of the places you can get it as well. And
I guess that's a mushroom, really.
It is. Yeah. So it's part of the, like, there's the different forces in nature, and one of them is the sort of the fermenting breakdown cycle, and that's where the vitamin B12 is part of. So you get it in algae as well, I think, from the sea. The sea is another, everything that lives in the sea is just another mind-blowing universe.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and so what are other vitamins? Well, vitamin C, go on.
Oh, well, we could, because we don't have too much time left, I wonder if we could briefly talk about like the five basic nutrients.
Yes.
I think that's quite important for, you know, foundations. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the five basic nutrients are proteins, carbohydrates, fats, vitamins, or the micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, and then water. Mm-hmm. It's important to remember water because without the water, nothing works. Mm-hmm. And just to do a short bit on water, that it's many diseases you can actually help get better just by having water. Like something like high blood pressure, you see that people that have high blood pressure are often dehydrated. And if they start getting hydrated again, their blood pressure falls. And of course, because as I said earlier, everything is about the blood and the blood bringing nutrients and taking away waste from all of the body cells, the blood needs to have water, not just be cells itself. Mm-hmm. Because in the way I see that is that if you're in on a crowded motorway, that you get problems all the time. But if you add space, which is like adding water to the blood, everything runs better. So water is a really important kind of nutrient. Yeah. Proteins are the building blocks. And they are made out of amino acids, and some of the amino acids are essential. So meaning that we have to have them in the diet. We can't make them ourselves. But the proteins or the amino acids are like an alphabet. So you can make hundreds of millions of thousands of words with your alphabet. And that's like you can make different proteins.
Yeah.
So, but you just need to have your alphabet. Otherwise, you're limited in the amount of different proteins you can make. So since they're building blocks, it's important to remember that you shouldn't, in my view, have too many proteins. Because like if you're building your house, when you've done your walls and your windows and your doors and furniture and so on, if you carry on adding building blocks, then there's no room for you in the house in the end. So it's very clever the way the body is made. So the reason you can use proteins as part of a slimming regime is that because they're so important for your structure, the hunger center in the brain is controlled by protein. So that's why if you eat lots of protein, the brain will say you've had enough now because you have built your structure, you don't need any more. But the difficulty with having a high protein diet is that any protein you don't need, you will excrete through the kidneys. And so they can create problems, kidney problems. And of course, the kidneys are, like in Chinese medicine, they say that's where your life force comes from. So the kidneys are super important to keep happy and healthy. So yeah. You need your amino acids, and you can get the essential amino acids. You can get them all from plants as well. Of course, they can be, you can say that they're easier to get from animal tissues because animals, and we are sort of animals as well. So mm-hmm. their amino acid combination is closer to our own than plants. But having said that, there was a Danish doctor called Mikkel Hinhede, who was, it's a long story I won't bore you with now, but he studied, he came from Western Jutland where they didn't have a lot of animal protein, and they just lived off potatoes. And he thought, this is really strange. These strong farm workers, they don't eat much else than potatoes. How come they can build all that tissue then without anything else? And he studied, like in Ireland, they lived off potatoes as well. And he had the whole Danish nation during this First World War basically live off vegetables and basing their diet on potatoes, and the whole nation became healthier. And now it has turned out 100 years later that, in fact, the protein, the amino acid combination in potatoes is very close to human. And potatoes contain something like, I think it's 12% protein. So you can actually satisfy your protein need with potatoes. So that was proteins. Then there's carbohydrates, which we get from plants. And carbohydrates, we say now, don't have too many carbs. And what people mean when they say that is basically don't have too many refined carbohydrates, and that's either in the form of sugar or in the form of starch. Mm-hmm. But if you have them, in my view, what it's all about is whether you have extrinsic or intrinsic sugar. Mm-hmm. The extrinsic sugar is sugar that has been taken out of their natural combination inside the cells. So syrup and honey and added sugar is all extrinsic, but so is flour and like white bread is also a kind of extrinsic sugar. Whereas anything that's unprocessed and whole grain, the sugar is still kept within the cell walls, so it's slower absorbed, and therefore it doesn't upset your blood sugar so much, and it also isn't absorbed into your tissues so fast and convert it into fat, which is what we don't want. And but it's available, so you can use it immediately.
Is that like the difference between a simple carbohydrate and a complex carbohydrate, or is it different?
No, because starches are the complex carbohydrates. They're polysaccharides, so many sugar molecules together. They can be extrinsic or intrinsic, but simple carbohydrates are monosaccharides, and then there's disaccharides. So monosaccharides is what the brain basically needs, and that's what's in fruit sugar. And you need a certain amount of monosaccharides to keep your brain functioning. The body can make its own. If you are on a keto diet or you're on a water fast, you can make your own monosaccharides for the brain as well, but it's a slower process. And the disaccharides, what's in basically in sugar, the added sugar. So there are also fruit sugars, but also things from sugar beets and from sugar canes and so on is disaccharides. So the long polysaccharides are the ones that give you a more steady energy, because the saccharides need to be broken down before you can use them. So that's where you talk about carbohydrate loading. You do that with when you eat polysaccharides, because you break them down slowly. And once they're broken down into monosaccharides, then they are absorbed into your tissues and converted into fat. And that's why we all have fat reserves that are, and fats bring me on to the next type. Fats are basically, so they're part of enzymes and sort of various metabolic processes, but fat is also a way of storing a lot of energy. So carbohydrate, you can use protein as energy as well, but it's very expensive energy, because it's basically like burning your house to keep warm. It's much better to get in some groceries and burning those. But proteins and carbohydrates both contain 4 calories per gram, but fats contain 9 calories per gram. And that is a really smart, again, nature's so amazing. That's a very smart way of storing energy, because that means you can store over twice as much energy on the same weight. You see what I mean?
Right. So once you've converted
So once you've converted your energy into fat, you can carry twice as much energy on with the same weight as if it was carbohydrates. And of course, that's important for us, but it's even more important for birds that fly from one end of the world to the other on their energy reserves. But the downside of fats then is that if you want to lose fats, it's this very concentrated energy that takes ages to lose. And when you think about it, we need about 2,000 calories a day for our sort of basic needs. So if you're burning 2,000 calories in a day, that means that it'll take you about 4.5 days to burn a kilo of fat. So if you, like me, could easily lose 10 kilos, that will then take you, 45 days without eating anything at all. So that's why it's so difficult to lose fat once you've built it up. But you need your fat, of course, for everything to work in the body. And also it's insulation, isn't it? And it's insulation around nerves and organs and side bones and so on. So those are the macronutrients. Then there's the micronutrients, which are the vitamins and minerals. Mm-hmm. And they are all in their individual ways used as catalysts to make everything function better. That's the sort of basic way of saying that. Apart from some of the minerals, of course, are also used to make bones and various tissues. And that's why it can be very difficult to take minerals and as supplements, because the body makes sure that you don't absorb more minerals than you need at any given time, because otherwise it's like when you've made your bones, even though there's some turnover, you don't want too much more calcium, because it'll just clog up your system. Though of course calcium is also used in the calcium channels, letting energy in and out of cells, so the bones in the body, the skeleton, is really just the calcium bank, which is why it can be so difficult to get to grips with the osteoporosis when you're just taking calcium out of your bank all the time. And that's why there's more to osteoporosis than just eating calcium, because you need to be able to absorb it as well. And it needs to get out of the bloodstream and into your bones. And that's, of course, another use for vitamin D. You can't absorb calcium without and absorb it into your bones without vitamin D, bringing us neatly back to vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. So yeah, that's a really great breakdown of the nutrients and sort of the foundation of your book, which is out now on Aon. But before we wrap up, how can people get a hold of you or get your book or find out about what you're offering?
Yeah, so they can get the book from Aon, and I think it's also available on Amazon. And if you, I think there's a discount code, you get 20% off if you buy it before the 29th of November.
And yeah, we'll have the discount code in the description below.
Fantastic. Brilliant. And you can also, I have a website called thehealinggarden.uk, all one word. And there you can get hold of me. I do Zoom consultations with people from various places in the world. And I also do in-person consultations here in my clinic where I'm sitting now. And we also do a nature cure training with my husband, where we look at, so that it's about, he talks about the body as the human ecosystem and how we're related to the ecosystem we live in. And I talk about the different plants and foods that help that ecosystem work. And we make lots of different products and things from the from the garden. And we have it's divided up into the different seasons. So at the moment, from the autumn equinox to the winter solstice, we are in the root season. Then if we move on to leaves start appearing, so then we're in the leaf season from the winter solstice to the spring equinox. Then we go into the flower season from the spring equinox to the summer solstice. And then it's seeds and berries from the summer solstice to the autumn equinox. So we look at that, those different parts of the plants and how the energy moves through the plant and also through nature, like all directed by light, because we're, you know, as the light disappears, the water appears. And then as the sun gains power, there's more fire and light and the water recedes. So that's
you and Nick you and Nick are a healing dream team.
Yeah. 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 I think you are too.
Thanks.
I feel very akin to you.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
You're
so
a herbalist
much.
As well, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. Do you do consultations as well? Do you give consultations where you are?
I'm not so much of like a clinical, like I don't advertise consultations, but I do a lot of consultations just with family and friends and neighbors and friends of friends who come to me. So I'm kept very busy with that work and with the growing and making of the products and things like that as well.
Amazing. I think that's the right way to do it, because everyone is a herbalist inside. I think it's when you connect with plants, as we talked about earlier, you can help others connect with them too, and that to me is the road to health.
Exactly. That's definitely one of the things that brings me most joy, is connecting people with plants and with each other. But
Well, thank you, Kirsten, for being on the show again.
Thank you, Kirsten. This has been an awesome chat.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.